Take a deep breath. Relax. Inhale through your nose and exhale through your mouth. Sit back and close your eyes. Gradually release the tension, starting from your toes, working up your legs to your pelvis, and from your fingertips, slowly up your arms to your shoulders. The Stacking Benjamins Show, no matter how bad it gets, is your favorite podcast. I will count backwards from three, and when I snap my fingers, you'll be overcome with delight at hearing the start of this episode. 3, 2, 1.
Live from Texarkana's only notable basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. Everybody, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and we've got a double treat for you today. First, it's cleaning day, and I found my old family photo albums. Hey, how about this? Instead of listening to these dorks talk money, how about if I share the history of my family in photos? Boy, did my meemaw have a hairy chin.
What? What do you mean just do the intro?
All right. On today's show, we welcome the budgetnista herself, Tiffany Alice. Also, some big money headlines, a Quotacy hotline call from Evan about Roth IRA rebalancing, a special letter from the mailbag, and more. And here they are, two guys who aren't nearly as thrilling as what could have been an epic trip through Doug's past, Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
This is a little more exciting than looking at family photos.
Just a smidge, right?
Although if it were my family photos, I'd feel completely different. Let's go look at those instead of Doug's.
Yeah, I don't want to look at your family photos either.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the place where we look at the value of a sandwich. My name is Joe Salci. I average Joe Money on Twitter. We do say a lot on this show. We've got Tiffany Alice on. She's the budgetnista coming down to the basement. I love that. I love her moniker.
That's a good way to do it.
The budgetnista. And we've wanted to have Tiffany on the show for a long time. She helps a ton of people. She was in big debt herself. And like a lot of the people out there that know how to do things, you know, she started off OG. She started off helping herself, right? She became this online person so she could hold herself accountable. And now she holds other people accountable. So she's coming down to the basement today. But first, we got some great headlines. But even before that, you know what we got? We've got $100 to people that go to SoFi using our link, stackybenjamins.com/SoFi. If they use just that link for a personal loan or for a student loan, and really you should check it out because when people go to SoFi for their student loans, they find that they can save a lot of money on those student loan refinances. So a little bit different for every person. So you got to check it out first. StackingBenjamins.com/SOFI. They also do mortgages. They can't give you $100 for a mortgage. Apparently that's against the rules. Rules are annoying, aren't they?
Believe you me, I know a thing or two about rules.
but they will.
And how annoying they are.
I know. But they will throw in $100 for the other two. And you'll know that SoFi is the place to go when you head to stackybenjamins.com/magnifymoney, because at magnifymoney.com, you can be completely anonymous while you shop those banking products, that checking account, that savings account, and those debt products that you have. Why spend time on your company's website, your banking company's website, looking around for maybe the best CD they have, when you could take a look at all the products that are out there? 92% of the products that are available are on magnifymoney.com, stackybenjamins.com/magnifymoney. Average person who goes there saves $450. That's a lot. Nice. A lot of jingle in this show.
Cheddar. That's a lot of cheddar.
Tiffany Alice coming down to the basement. But first, man, we got some big headlines. So let's move.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's headlines.
Our first headline comes to us from Napa-Napa. This has been all over the news, man. I heard it in the car just today again. Excessive fee litigation hits the education sector. The law firm of Schlichter, Bogart, and Denton has now turned its attention to the education sector, filing separate class action lawsuits against three universities on behalf of over 60,000 employees and their defined contribution retirement plans, both 401k and 403b. And by the way, these aren't small colleges that they're going after. How about NYU, Yale, and MIT? Maybe some fairly large institutions. We contend that these universities as fiduciaries have breached their duties under the law to protect the retirement assets of their employees and retirees, Jerry Schlichter of Schlichter, Bogart, and Denton, the attorney for the plaintiff, stated. These university employees deserve the same right to build meaningful retirement assets as employees of for-profit companies, Mr. Schlichter added. This is the same company that's gone after some of the biggest companies out there. And in my day as a financial advisor, and it might have changed, so you need to tell me, universities and schools, way higher fees, way, way higher fees in a lot of their plans than 401ks had.
Yeah, I don't know. It just kind of depends on the company, right? I mean, every company has a little different fee structure. I don't know that I've observed that so much, that same thing, but this rubs me the wrong way.
I think
it's this whole lawsuit idea.
I don't know, man. When I worked with teachers and I'd look at some of their 403b plans that they had, they were just horrible. I mean, I could have made a living just changing teachers' 403b plans over to much better, much less expensive 403b plans. Some of the 403b plans that school districts let in to their districts were horrible. And I'm not going to name names, but two come to mind immediately.
Well, again, it was a beauty contest, right? The whole 403b market, especially when it comes to schools, because most and every school district, every state's going to be different in their rules. But the areas that I've lived and been in business in work very similarly in that if there's enough groundswell and that threshold, by the way, is really low. It's like if there's 10 people who say they want in XYZ company, the administration will just put it on the list. And you said that you could make a living on fixing those things. I know lots of people who made a living selling those things and did take advantage of teachers. But this isn't local schools. This is big universities. And so how is this the school's responsibility? I mean, I get, you know, I understand what he's saying. It's their fiduciary responsibility. But when the products themselves are what you look at the biggest companies that service the higher education market, right? Fidelity, TIAA, CREF, Vanguard are the three that come to mind. They set the market for that, right?
What they're saying is that those three universities in particular have billions of dollars in these plans, and the fiduciaries at the university did not attempt to use that leverage to lower the cost of those plans, that they didn't.
I would find that hard to believe, but okay.
Yeah, well, I guess time will tell, huh?
Yeah, this reeks of frivolous ambulance chasing to me.
I don't know, man. When I saw, because I also worked with some university professors when I was an advisor in Michigan, and their plans were high fee plans. So I think there's
or the benefits. Was there a trade off?
You mean they were 403b plans? They were 403b, okay. So they were regular plans with regular funds inside of them. Okay. You know, and I wasn't excited about those plans. And I was incredibly frustrated sometimes with trying to help people move money around inside those plans at universities. And at a certain point, I mean, I'm with you. I don't like seeing lawsuits, but on the other side, I think that's why the legal system exists, right? If your company won't listen, if your employer won't listen, well then guess what? I do have a course of action here. And it seems like these companies and universities, a lot of them don't pay enough attention. But historically, I think companies thought that this was an opportunity. Okay, I get rid of the pension. I don't got to do that anymore. Thank God. You know what? I can hand it off to you. And I'll have Joe, who represents some fun family over here. I'll have him come in. He takes care of it. I don't got to worry about it anymore. And it also seemed like nobody was ever checking to see if companies were there was no backbone to the ERISA rules that said that companies had to bring in, you know, people to talk about how to use the 401k or the 403b. There was no checking to see if companies had egregious fees. There was nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think all of that is true. But again, the statement that you read right at the beginning from the lead attorney,
yeah,
that says people deserve the right to be able to accumulate retirement savings, right?
Deserve the right to build meaningful retirement assets as employees of for-profit.
So he is asserting that the reason that they don't have meaningful retirement balances is because of this extra 0.5% fee.
I don't know what the difference is in their fee, but
pick a number based on our, what about our story last episode, right? Where we were talking about the average investor gets 1-something%. The average market return is 10. Is the gap there because of the insert extra fee percent, or is it because of not saving enough money, being stupid with it and all that sort of stuff?
I agree. It's a wrong dragon. It's not number one, but I still don't think that this is a bad move. I don't think, I agree. If people hear our headline here and they're like, that's the reason I'm not retiring is because the fees in my plan are too high. You're right. That's the wrong message. However,
but that's the message that you hear. You hear it here. You hear that with this article and you hear that message, you know, on television when the ambulance chasers, pardon me if that's what your job is, says, you know, did you work at this company? Well, they probably charged you excess fees. You're entitled to, and look at the payout on this. So what's going to happen? And let's just fast forward to the end of this. What happens? Is there some meaningful change moving forward? Maybe some market change. What happens to the $100 million settlement?
Right. Well, I agree. Attorneys are going to make a lot of money. Universities are going to have more law cost programs. People still aren't going to retire when they want to because they don't save any money.
So the employees of the university are going to get $2.47. The attorneys are going to get $47 million.
Yeah.
And what do you think the university does? Are universities for-profit or not-for-profit?
Not-for-profit.
So what happens when all of a sudden they're in the red the next year because of this $100 million settlement or whatever the number is?
They jack up tuition.
And who pays the tuition bill?
Yeah, me. Yeah. Right. We got to move on. Like this topic, we could probably just have one headline today, but I have another big one, which is also from the headlines last week. This is a big headline week, man. How about that? Sometimes I'm reaching for headlines because
you have to use the ones I send you.
Yeah. Oh, that was a good one on Monday. I like that one. What
tech man rescues cat from
this is from Investment News. What technology lessons advisors can learn from Delta Airlines system breakdown? Last week, as you know, Delta Airlines, their systems.
I'm so happy I'm not flying.
Crashed. And boy, what a mess. 3 days in a row, and even longer for some people. Just absolutely horrible things going on with Delta Airlines. It says facing a crisis without a plan can be detrimental to an advisor's brand. Advisors need more than one backup plan to avoid potential disasters. Now, I'm quoting this article because it's about advisors and it's for advisors, but I think there's a bigger lesson than just advisors here. I think everybody needs a backup plan, right?
Well, think of it from a technology standpoint. I just saw a Facebook post from a friend of mine that was fretting over, hey, I just plugged in my external hard drive with my entire life supply of pictures on it and it fried.
Right. I had that. My pictures were stolen.
Yeah, you had the same thing. What do I do? And you go, uh-oh. So this person took it to a computer repair person. They were able to fix it for $1,500. Now, talk about extortion, right? I mean, you could charge whatever the heck you wanted if you were the guy that knew how to fix hard drives, you know, and it had, you know, your lifetime pictures on it. But same thing is true in advisors' businesses. If all of a sudden your computer's stolen, it's got your client data on it, or your house burns down and you work from home, or your office is in a natural disaster of some kind, that happens all the time. So what is the plan? And the SEC and individual states now are mandating that advisors have what's called a business continuity plan. So what do you do if all of a sudden your building collapses? Where can clients go? What can clients do to know that you're up and running?
And I think even if you don't work with a financial advisor, I think we need to have those same plans because I love, one of my favorite books, as you know, is called The Art of War.
And my favorite book is The War of Art.
It's an ancient book about Chinese military systems. And there's a great line in that book that says, the best battle is the one that's never fought. I feel like I spent 18 years while my kids were at home telling them that in different ways. You know what? You wouldn't have had that problem had you done this thing beforehand. This could have prevented that problem. And it's funny because just having these backup systems in place, whether you work with an advisor or not, so important to back up your, like, think about your financial data. Is it in a place that's fireproof? Number one. is it in a place that is difficult for hackers to get at, right? That's number two. Even though this is going to sound a little cynical, Paula Pant might have said this first on our show. You just kind of assume hackers already have all your stuff, right?
I do.
It is.
But there's some simple things. Like, for example, when I travel for work, I have this, you know, I use a MacBook, an iPad, and an iPhone. That encompasses 99% of the work that I do, right? And there's a company that I bought a subscription to called Private Wi-Fi. What it does is it encrypts your Wi-Fi data if you're in a place where it's not encrypted.
Like a hotel, yeah.
Coffee shop, whatever. And you can get 5 licenses per subscription. I think it's under $100 a year for the subscription.
That's great.
So you just go, you log into the hotel and it pops up right away and says, this wireless is not secure. And you click secure it, boom. And now you've taken the step, right? You can show that at least you've done what you can do. I'm with you. I think the data's probably already been stolen 16 times.
But you still want it where you can get at it, where if bad things happen, you have that stuff at your fingertips. Like, you know what happens when somebody dies, right? Somebody passes away. Nobody can find the insurance policies. They don't know what they had. There's no continuity plan. And advisors have to have a continuity plan. I think individuals should think about the same thing. Good stuff. I think our lessons for today, that was number one. What's your continuity plan? And lesson number two is, yeah, I do think you and I are going to disagree on this, but I think these lawsuits are good. And I think companies need to pay more attention. But you and I agree on, I think, what our number two point is. Your retirement plan fees is not the reason why you're not retiring on time.
Right. My lesson is that I need somebody to come in here and hit delete on my browsing history if I get hit by lightning.
ASAP, before mom finds it.
That's your job, Joe. You run over, you're kicking the door in. Mrs. OG's like, oh my God, have you heard? You're like, yeah, where's this computer? Right. Delete, 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 delete.
I got to go get that box out of the bottom of OG's closet.
Yeah.
Right. I'm so excited we finally have Tiffany Alice coming down to the basement, OG. It's about time somebody that knew how to clean up debt came down to the basement.
We've never had anybody like that, have we?
But it's
a never-ending battle, is it not? I mean,
and she is out there fighting the fight, which is why Tiffany Alice is called by her fans. She's called the Budget Nista. Her website, thebudgetnista.com. Right now, she has over 200,000 people are enrolled in her challenge to help them get their debt under control. That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of souls helping.
You have seen her on just about every single major network. She's been on all the major talk shows. She also has a podcast, the Brown Ambition Podcast, which she does with Mandy Woodruff. Used to be Yahoo Finance's editor, money editor. Now she's moved over to Magnify Money. How about that? So podcaster, entrepreneur, lifestyle expert, the Budget Nista, Tiffany Alice, coming down to the basement. And the Budget Nista herself, Tiffany Alice, joins us in the basement. Welcome.
Hey, Joe. Let me get situated on this beanbag real quick. Can I get a snack? I see those peaches in the corner. Are those for eating or just for show?
Well, those are wild because we got to open up. We got to have mom come down and open up the jars, you know?
Okay.
So afterwards.
Well, okay, cool.
Peaches afterwards. We get to talk and learn all about you now, and then peaches later. How about that? If you do a good job, we'll give you peaches.
Ooh, those are my favorites. So, okay, I'm going to do a good job.
Well, we already had your partner in crime over at Brown Ambition, Mandy, on the show. So it's about time you finally came down.
Oh, Mandy's the straight man. I'm the silly one. We're going to see.
I got to ask you about your name. Where did the Budget Nista come from? Because your moniker is awesome.
Everyone says that. My little sister, honestly, she used to tell me that, you know, there's a fashionista, but she buys clothes. I should be the Budget Nista because I don't buy anything.
That's perfect.
She was a teenager at the time. I think she was trying to be snarky, but you know, it stuck.
It was either the Budget Nista or the Grinch. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically, or cheapo.
Right. Well, you also have a great personal story about debt. I was reading that. Did you get into $30,000 of debt in 1 week?
Oh man, like try 3 days.
That's a great 3 days.
I know, and I wish I would have had like something to like show for it. It was just credit card debt. It was an air quotes friend of mine. I told him I wanted to learn how to invest And he said, oh, you got to use other people's money. I didn't know what that meant. What he meant was open up some credit cards, get a cash advance.
Oh, no.
I've never heard of a cash advance before. I was in my mid-20s, and I said, okay. And so I took the money off. I invested it with him, and he probably stole it. So 3 days later, I was just like, hello, hello, hello? And he was gone.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, honestly, it took me a full year to accept the fact that he wasn't coming back. Because I used to call every day. And sometimes he would answer. And sometimes he would email me back. And so he strung me along for a long time before I realized, yeah, this is not going to happen.
So is he like a financial guy, a professional financial guy? Or was he just a friend who said he'd invest it?
Well, he was a friend. He was I had known him for 6 years and he was wealthy. I mean, he had like a Ferrari, at least as far as I could tell. He lived in this high rise in New York. And so I thought, wow, he's got money. So maybe he knows how to invest. And he said, yes, I do. And so I'm like, and now I realize, yeah, his business is probably robbing 25-year-olds.
Oh, yeah, right. It's a full-time job.
Yeah.
And not a very difficult one, apparently.
Apparently. What? I didn't even... Well, because my dad is like a finance guy. He's an accountant and a CFO. He's got two degrees in finance and economics. And so I didn't even tell him until I was in my 30s because I was so embarrassed and so like afraid to tell him because I thought he would be so disappointed. Like, after all I taught you.
Yeah, but still, you know, if you see somebody and they're successful, right? I mean, if they're really successful, they have all this stuff like you're talking about, you would think that that would be the most trustworthy person you could talk to.
Exactly. He wasn't a stranger. I mean, I knew him for about 2 years. I mean, about 6 years by then. So it wasn't. And he didn't approach me and say, hey, Tiffany, let's invest. I approached him. So I really thought, well, here's someone I can trust.
Yeah. Wow. Well, so how did you go about paying that money off then, Tiffany? Did you pay it off quickly? Like the Tiffany now, right, with all the challenges that you have and the books that you've written, you've got great strategies to pay off debt. But did you pay off that quickly or did you make some mistakes?
No, I made some mistakes. The first year, I refused to acknowledge it was my debt. It was his fault. That's what I used to tell myself every morning, filled with anger.
Yeah.
And then, you know, first year in shock. And then I used to, like, do the angry texts and calls. And then it was the crying. And then it was the, I'm resigned to this life of debt. And then finally, I took responsibility and promptly lost my job 3 days later.
Oh, no.
Yes, yes.
And those two things weren't related at all.
No, it was the height of the recession and I worked for a school. I was a teacher and we were a nonprofit based school and we lost our funding. So literally 3 days later of me saying, okay, Tiffany, you make enough to pay this off. Let's just start paying it off instead of just like, I was just paying the minimum at that time because I refused to acknowledge it was my fault as well. And so I made that decision and 3 days later, no job. And I was like, just great. And so I ended up moving back home. And back then, unemployment, you could be on unemployment for 2 years because everyone had lost their job. And I could not find another teaching job. But while I was on unemployment and because I moved back home and I rented out my condo that I owned, I was able to pay my mortgage and then use my unemployment to help me pay down the debt. And I got rid of it in about 2.5 years while not working.
Wow. Well, how did you do that? So it was cutting your living expenses or what?
I cut everything. Like if it was not a necessity, I didn't have to pay for food. I didn't have to pay for lodging because I moved back home with my parents.
Yeah.
So everything else, like I think I put my student loans in deferment and I really didn't have a whole lot of bills now that I didn't have a condo to take care of. Like I didn't have to pay my light bill, water bill because the person that lived there did that. So I was living very simply. I would say my life probably cost me like at the time, maybe like under $2,000 a month. And I think my unemployment check was like maybe $2,000 every 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, so I was really living super simply and just using that money to pay down. And I was just starting the Budgetista and getting paid a little bit here and there and putting it toward the debt.
Wow. So it sounds like in its infancy, the Budgetista was as much to empower you and to kind of help you cope as much as it was to help other people cope.
No, for sure. Like I was like it's like Frankenstein. That, you know, he experimented on himself. So everything, that's why I think the Budgetista brand does so well. One, I'm super transparent. I'm like, oh yeah. Oh, foreclosure did that. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Credit card debt, me too. And then I fixed it. And so what I'm teaching, I'm not teaching from a place of like, oh, I read it in a book somewhere.
Right.
This is what I learned in school. It's like, no, this was my actual life. I fixed it.
What are the biggest mistakes you find people that follow you make when they're trying to get out of debt?
Thinking that it's going to happen overnight.
Oh,
it took me like 2.5 years or being so down on themselves. we're so terrible to ourselves. Like the voices in our head, the way we talk to ourselves, you would never let anyone speak to you like that, I hope. But, you know, like, oh man, I've got this debt, or like my credit score dropped 1 point. I've seen people actually post in my Facebook group, my credit score has dropped 3 points. I feel so depressed. I'm like, it's 3 points. You didn't lose a finger. Right. You know?
Let's back up a second. You didn't lose a finger. Right.
It takes time. It took you a lot of time to get into the situation. It's going to take time to come out and not really congratulating themselves along the way. Like, you know what? You know, one woman wrote, she said, it's not much, but for the first time ever, I actually have some money left over before my check actually came. So, you know, people get paid, let's just say, on the 1st, and usually by the 15th, you're tapped out. She was like, it's the 15th, and I have 50 bucks. And she was like, I know that's not a lot, but like, honestly, like 600 people were like, no, that's amazing. You usually have nothing. That's a huge accomplishment. And I feel like people don't do that enough, pat themselves on the back when they make good financial choices.
Isn't it so exciting, though, just even hearing that story? It's not the problem. It's how you look at the problem.
Exactly. I truly believe that. That's with anything. Like people, like when I talk about budgets, they're like, oh God, budgets. But I love budget day, because budget day gets to tell me, my budget doesn't tell me no. My budget tells me yes. If you look to your budget for the no, that's what you're going to get. My budget always says yes, if. Yes, you can go, you know, I want to go to Thailand for my birthday in October. Yes, you can go to Thailand if you make these different choices. And so I think about thinking about things differently really changes everything.
How does your budget work? Do you close out the budget at the end of the month and then look forward?
Yeah. So typically, because I work for myself, it's a little different than when I was a school teacher. So typically what happens is that as soon as I know how much I need to make a month just to make my life happen.
Okay.
And as soon as I get paid anything, so I might get paid from a speaking engagement, or maybe I made book sales while I was at a book fair. As soon as I take that money, I allocate it. I set aside 20% for retirement. I set aside 30% for taxes. I set aside 10% I like to donate and give back. And really the rest I use to live off of. And if there's excess left over, I put some into like a business or my personal savings account to put toward next month's bills. But so, yeah, so usually I close out. And at the end of the month, I look to see like, okay, all that I've made, I have an Excel spreadsheet. All that I've made, did I allocate all that I was supposed to allocate and put into my separate categories? And if not, then I finish doing so and I close out the month.
Where do you find then the money for Thailand? Do you then back down the living expenses? Or you were talking earlier about getting ahead. Do you try to do more work, earn more income to make that happen?
Well, usually too, sometimes if there's enough. So let's just say I get a big check, like say a Prudential pays me $10,000.
Woohoo!
Right? I don't need $10,000 to make my life work. So there's money left over. So then with that money left over, I might put 5% into my travel account. I might put 5% into my house account. So when there's excess, I have other smaller accounts that I only give to when there's excess.
That's cool. Do you keep those then as separate, like separate bank accounts? Are they separate on a piece of paper? How are they different?
No, definitely separate bank accounts. Okay. I feel like it's like your mom's like or your grandma's envelope system. But instead of envelopes, I like to use bank accounts. And I like to use online only bank accounts for savings, like an Ally or a Barclays or Capital One 360 has one. And so the way it works is that I open up different bank accounts and you can name them. So that way when I pull up my Ally screen, it says travel, it says give. One says me. I have a me account for just like fun stuff. So if I put enough money in there, I could do whatever it is I want without guilt. And so you can name them, and that's how I keep track of like that excess money.
I didn't hear the Give to Joe account. I didn't hear that one.
Oh yeah, that one's coming next.
That's good. Excellent. Yeah. just go ahead and keep waiting for that one, Joe. That one's on the way. Guaranteed. Right. It's funny. You said one thing that I want to kind of go back to. You know how much it takes to keep the lights on. And that was like a big aha for me when I first became a financial planner. Like I'd never thought about it that way. Just if everything else goes to hell, right? Like I lose my job right after I start paying down my debt. How much do I need minimum to live? That's like a huge number to know.
It is. I call it your financial baseline. Like what is the bare minimum you've got to make just to make it work? Because with your financial baseline, you could do a lot with that. One, it lets you know, if I start my own business, what do I have to make in order to do so? Or two, if I hate my job and my boss is a total butthead, right?
Guy, right.
Like kids might be listening, right? Mandy's usually one for my podcast. She's usually the one that curses.
Right. We have to beep her. We have to beep her out.
So if that happens, What do I have to make of my next job? Like if I find a job I actually like, but they're not paying me as much. You know, what's the bare minimum I've got to negotiate to make so I can move from here?
Yeah, everything from negotiations to negotiating with yourself. I mean, just across the board, that's powerful. Uh-huh. What are the easiest places you find people could cut, but they don't?
Basic things like cable, of course, everybody knows that. But like even eating out, groceries for sure. I'm like the worst with groceries.
What do you mean?
Meaning that people don't coupon. I mean, because you're like, I don't want a coupon. Yeah. But I have some of my friends, honestly, they spent like $40 on $400 worth of food. Like, that's a huge saving.
Holy crap.
Yeah. So couponing. Some other things you could do is just like entertainment. I find people spend a whole lot of money on grooming. So you could still like, obviously, like, you know, get your hair cut and stuff like that. But there might be a less expensive way to do so, or learning how to do some of that thing, some of those things on your own.
On haircutting, I just decided I wouldn't have hair, and that would
your hair agreed with you.
That would pretty much do it. Yeah, my hair decided to cut itself. Let's put it that way.
No, but it's just the excess spending. I call it the cash spending. Things that you usually use your debit card for or cash for, those are where you have the most. That's where you have the most control. So really looking at, like, pull up your bank statement, the bank account that's attached to your debit card. Where's your money really going? Get a calculator out. Wow, I'm spending this much money on McDonald's a month. Yep.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, or eating out or movies or some other things that, not to say that I don't believe in over sacrifice. People think because I'm the budgetista, I'm super like, I don't do anything. That's not true. I've just learned to save where I can so I can splurge where I want.
Right. Our friend Paula Pant says you can afford anything, just not everything.
Exactly.
You have helped. I think the number is well into the multiple thousands and thousands of people. Tell me a story that really surprised even you.
Well, so we're up to nearly 200,000 women.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's a monster number.
It's crazy. And so, but one story, I'll tell you two real quick. One, a woman emailed me. I remember she'd emailed me. She said, you know, I'm currently staying in a homeless shelter, but I'm still doing your Live Richer Challenge. And I'm using my phone to do so. And I just want to thank you. She wasn't asking for anything. She just wanted to kind of like, just let me know. And then 2 years later, she emailed me to say, I just closed on my home today, my first home. Oh, and I was like, whoa. She's like, I could not have gotten here without your Live Richer Challenge. And I just want, you know, obviously it's not just that. But like, she had to do other things. But she was like, you just put me on a path to understand why my money was doing what it was doing and put me on a path to do better by it. And I thought, whoa. So that was like an uplifting one. And then there was a woman who wrote me once. She was in a really abusive relationship. Her husband was really abusive physically and I guess emotionally and as well as financially abusive. And she's like, I've been secretly doing the Live Richer Challenge and I finally have enough squirreled away to kind of take care of myself and leave. And I thought, wow. Because, you know, you think when you're helping people, you're like, oh, you know, here's your budget. It's not, especially not with women. It's so much bigger than that. Like, people live better lives. A woman told me once that for the first time in my adult life, I paid all my bills. Like, on time. She's like, do you even know what that means? And a woman told me once she had never been able to go on vacation ever. And she had saved enough to take her and her daughter, who just graduated high school, as a gift to her daughter they went away to Mexico or something. Like, that's going to transform the way her daughter thinks about money and what she's able to do with it. And so it just, the stories like that just made me realize, wow, it's so much more than money. It really is a movement.
Yeah. And it's funny. It starts with just these little tiny actions, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these little tiny things people do add up to these big things like a new house or a trip that they didn't know they could take.
Exactly. Or just transforming your life, buying a house when you were once homeless, leaving an abusive relationship. You know, people don't realize the effect that finances has on not just your financial life, but your whole life.
Yeah, that's what there's somebody that I've known for a long time who spends a lot of time miserable telling everybody that her life is not about money. And my life isn't about money either. But I'm right there with you, Tiffany. It's about choices. Like, I could care less about money. I just want that flexibility to do what I want to do.
Exactly. Money is a tool. My dad would say, like, money is a tool, like a hammer. So you can use a hammer to build a house, but you can use that same hammer to destroy a house. The hammer is not good or bad. It's the person using it that decides what the hammer does. So same thing with money. I agree. Money doesn't particularly move me, but I understand that it's a tool that if used properly, I can use it as one of the tools that I use to make my life better.
That's awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit about the challenge because people can get in on the challenge, right?
They sure can.
Awesome. How do they do it?
So they can go to liverichurchallenge.com. LiveRichYourChallenge.com. You can sign up for the challenge. It's completely free. And there you're going to learn how to budget, save, get out of debt, fix your credit, start to begin to invest and adjust your insurance. I did it because so many, especially women from across the country, used to reach out to me all the time on social media and say, help, help, help. And I thought, well, how can I be of service and help without personally helping each individual woman? Because they'd want to sit down with me. And so I used to be a school teacher. I'm like, you know how to write curriculum. You know how to write lessons. So why not do a month's worth of lessons that do one particular task each day that leads them toward changing their financial life? So I created the challenge 2 years ago. We've already saved like nearly $20 million between all of us. And we've got this awesome Facebook group of over 100,000 women from around the world. I remember the first time a woman emailed me from a different country. She had signed up for the challenge. And in the challenge, I say, where do you live? And I give you a choice of states. And she emailed me and said, hey, I'm emailing you from Kenya. And I don't live in the state. So what do I put here? I didn't even know what to say. I'm like, Kenya? How in the heck? How did you find me? And then Russia emailed me. And then somebody from Korea. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And now we have well over 100 different countries participating. It's insane.
That's wild. So you had to translate everything into rubles?
No. But you know what? But I'm very mindful now to make sure that the advice is basic financial principles versus stuff that just works in the United States.
Yeah, that's cool. And your website's thebudgetnista.com if people want to book you to speak or if they want to read your books and all that. So get some of your cool swag, too.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Absolutely. So what's next for you? Speaking of that, what's coming up on Tiffany's calendar?
So every year we do a new challenge. So 2017, we'll be doing the Live Richer Challenge, the credit edition. So that's next. And I'm actually working on a children's book.
No way. Really?
Yeah. You know, I wrote it a long time ago. I used to be a preschool teacher. So I've read literally thousands of children's books. And I would read these children. There's not too many that really help children understand finance, not in a way that's age appropriate. And, you know, of course, not even just like this is a dollar. This is what a dollar looks like. But to me, personal finance is also just about personal responsibility, about giving, about sharing, about being responsible with resources. And so I really want to write a series of books based upon a little girl that teaches through her experiences of doing things right and doing things wrong, kids about money, but in a larger sense, you know, not just about, like I said, this is a dollar, although we'll have that as well. And what I envision is that this little girl, you know, like Dora the Explorer, I want her to be like the Dora the Explorer of money. I want her to be on TV, this little cartoon character girl, teaching kids around the globe about personal finance and personal responsibility.
Too bad you're never doing anything.
I know. I'm always reaching high, you know.
I know. Oh, and you're going to...
Just a little world domination through the Budgetnista.
It is fantastic. I love it. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Thank you, Joe. I had a great time. So, about these peaches.
Hey everyone, it's Joe's mom's neighbor, Duggan. This old photo album I found really tells a story I didn't know. I'm thinking about starting an ice cream company, right? And as it turns out, the family business was selling ice cream. I always knew that rockets and push-ups were in my blood. I can always feel that sweet, sugary pull on my veins when the delicious chocolate, or vanilla, swan song of the ice cream truck music wafts in the neighborhood air. Ah, yes, the entrepreneur's spirit is in my blood. But I have a problem, and maybe you, dear Stacking Benjamin's family, have the answer. See, I'm lactose intolerant, and I really can't stand those little booger eaters who follow the ice cream truck around. What am I going to do? I must carry on the family legacy, but I'm really in a bind here. But first, I got to carry out my other duty. So here we go. Here's your trivia. Today's question, how much is the average kid going to spend on back-to-school shopping? The answer, right after this.
I'm so excited to have two sponsors that we really love that are super helpful to so many people. Our first is Magnify Money. Check them out at stackingbenjamins.com/magnifymoney. And if you're somebody like a lot of us that didn't get an education about money in school, well, guess what? Magnify Money will not only help you compare your checking, your savings, and your credit cards, they also have a graduate guide. What's a graduate guide? Well, Nick Clements, CEO of Magnify Money, told us what it's all about.
Right. Well, we went out and we pulled recent college graduates who are about 5 years out and said, what are your biggest regrets? And some of their biggest regrets were not handling their student loans right away when they got out of school, organizing them and finding out the best way to pay and manage that going forward. And another was just not learning enough about their personal finances. And so what we've done is, based upon the regrets of people who graduated 5 years ago, we put together a checklist so that as long as you follow that list, you at least will not have the regrets, the same regrets that these people have.
There it is. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money for you or the graduate in your life to get an education about getting their financial house in order. And if you've listened to the show before, you know I'm also excited about our second sponsor, SoFi. That's S-O-F-I. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi to check them out. And I've said in the past that you're not going to beat the interest rate on a student loan or on personal loans or mortgages outside of SoFi. However, I've also said you need a high credit score. What is a high credit score? And how does SoFi look at your credit? We asked Dan Macklin over at SoFi how it works.
So there's no absolute minimum that we have. But generally, if you're in the 700s and above, then you have a great chance of being approved. But credit score is not the only thing we're looking for. There's a variety of measures, but it's one of them.
So even though it's not the only thing they look at, it's an important qualifier. So clean up your credit and then head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi when you're ready to get your mortgage, refinance your debt through a personal loan, or look at those student loans to get the interest rate down to something more manageable.
Everyone, it's Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and the history of my family gets better every minute. Turns out, my Uncle Larry created the original, emphasis on original, fudge bar. No wonder nobody in the family liked him. Who eats that shit? Before the break, I asked you a trivia question, which was this. How much is the average kid going to spend on back-to-school shopping? Now, before you go and accuse us of fudging the numbers, according to USA Today, the average amount spent on back-to-school shopping is $917 per child. Man, the Budgetista's not going to like that. Maybe you should contemplate that answer with a slideshow about my family history. What? God, okay. I'll wrap it up. Back to these two dorks.
You had it halfway.
Yeah.
They're right. Tiffany won't like that number.
Does that include clothes, maybe?
Yeah, that's everything.
Yeah,
that still is a lot of money. $1,000 per kid. You've got three. Was that hair turning gray? Is that what that was?
Trust me, my kids' cost is not the back to school funds that run me dry.
It's everything else.
It's the lights that are always on. It's the AC that they willy nilly turn to like weird temperature. Like it's too hot in here, and they turn it to 61. Right. You're like, what are you doing? The AC Nest emailed me and said, are you okay? We assume you're frozen to death in your house.
Is your house a freezer?
I know. What are you, hanging meat in there?
Hey, let's fire up the quotas.
Then the kids are upstairs under their blankets because it's too cold.
Yeah, it's weird. That Nest thermostat, it twists, but it only twists one way, apparently.
Yeah.
Only goes down. Hey, let's fire up the quotas hotline. Why spend time with a boring insurance agent when with a very quick few keystrokes, you can head to stackybenjamins.com/quotacy and get quotes from 17 of the biggest insurers in the land. Use our link stackybenjamins.com/quotacy to tell them that we sent you. And on today's Quotacy hotline, it's Evan. Say hello, Evan.
Hey, Joe and OG. Evan here. Been listening to you guys for about half a year now and haven't learned one thing. And thank you for wasting my time during my morning commutes. I really appreciate it. My wife and I, age 28 right now, just maxing out our Roth IRAs every year and contributing as much as we can to our 401k, 403b. I have a couple questions here. First one is more for our Roth, and it deals with rebalancing our asset allocation. And I know there's a lot that goes into it, but I guess curious to get your thoughts on, you know, if there's a certain time during the year when it makes more sense to rebalance. Also, maybe the frequency on rebalancing. Maybe it's monthly, quarterly, annually, semi-annually. And then also, if you guys advise any percentages as far as the changes that it fluctuates. And then my second question is more on the other side of the spectrum, and that's when I retire. Just curious to get your thoughts on when I do want to pull money out of my IRA, is there a specific methodology between, you know, maybe take more money out of the bonds asset class or maybe out of stocks or maybe just equally prorated? Just curious to see what you guys think. Thanks again for everything. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thanks for the question, Evan. Fantastic questions, isn't that? Oh, gee. You've got this devious look in your eye.
I can't imagine why you'd take any money out of your bond portfolio in retirement, because I can't imagine why you'd actually even have bonds in retirement. So.
Easy. Let's pretend that you do, but we'll get to that shortly. Let's talk first of all.
You want to do the first one?
Yeah.
Two ways to do this. The do-it-yourself program is once a year, pick a day, do it.
Yeah.
There's no statistical evidence to suggest that more frequent rebalancing, more frequent than once a year, provides any value. So if, God forbid, you've got a transaction cost in there, maybe, you know, it's $9 to trade an ETF or something like that in your online account or something. You certainly don't want to be incurring that every month or quarter or whatever.
But you did like rebalancing during Brexit, the whole Brexit, you know, debacle.
So I said there's two ways. Could I give you the two, or are you going to interrupt me halfway through?
I'm going to totally interrupt you halfway through, cool. Apparently.
All right. So you did that. So check that box off. Interrupt OG. Got it. So the do-it-yourself plan is pick a day once a year, and that's always the day you do it. The first trading day of the year, your anniversary, your birthday, doesn't matter. Second option, which is what we do, but we've got technology that helps us with this, is that we look at the portfolios on a daily basis. And when they sway more than 20% from the target number in terms of the allocation, that's when we'll rebalance that position. So for example, if we wanted to have 10% in ABC fund, and today it's at 12.2%, well, that will precipitate a rebalance in that position. And then the technology that we use helps that, you know, manage that for all of our clients. But that's only because I can do it electronically without having to do the math on it every single day for every single client. Doing it on your own every single day for, you know, would be kind of a pain in the butt. So in that case, I would just do it once a year. But we look at it daily. We don't rebalance daily, but we look at it for opportunities.
Yeah, for the thresholds, either yes. Too low,
which
too high.
And that was part of his second question, which is what would those numbers be? I use 20%. Yeah. So not 20%, but 20% of the number. So
right.
If our target's 10, we're going to do between 8 and 12 is acceptable.
Got it. Yeah. And then the second question, when he's taking money out, is it better to take out from bonds, better to take out from stocks?
A, I'm not going to have any bonds.
Let's say, though, that you just inherited a client, because I'm going to make you answer this question. Let's say that you just inherited a client and they have stocks, bonds, everything.
Right. So we sell all the bonds and put it in equities. I'm not joking. I take money out for clients the same way we put money in. We dollar cost average out. So if your portfolio is a 60-40% stocks versus bonds portfolio, and you need $2,000 a month in retirement out of your portfolio, we are going to systematically sell $2,000 per month from the portfolio every month. And then that's how you're going to take the money out. So it leaves all the money invested. Of course, my asterisk is we always have 2 years worth of distributions in cash for that oh crap moment and so on and so forth.
2007, 2008, that kind of thing.
Yeah, more 2008, 2009.
Right, good point. Yeah.
But I dollar cost average out in the same proportion that I dollar cost average in.
It's funny because a question that Evan didn't ask, which I think is a more important question, is when do you decide
from which type accounts?
Exactly. Because Here's what I like. As you know, OG, I really like having some money in a Roth, some money in a traditional, which is why I think it's also a little more art than science choosing which one for today for two reasons. A, we don't know how much money we're going to need in the future. But B, we also don't know where tax brackets are going to be in the future, right? We kind of assume if they're going to stay the same or be higher, that the younger you are, the more money you put in Roth, the less money you put in traditional. But I still want to have money in both so that the way tax brackets work is they're marginal. So let's say that I'm, you know, living in the 25% tax bracket the way it is today. I take as much money as I can out of the traditional up to the top of the 15% bracket, the bracket before that, out of the traditional. So I pay 15% tax on all that money. And then all the money in the 25% bracket, the next bracket, I take out of the Roth so that I'm living comfortably in the 25% bracket, but I'm only being taxed at the top bracket being 15%. I really, really like both of those together. Works really well. I think that's probably the more important question. Yeah. Which type of fund do I use?
Well, in your specific case will be different than everybody else's
based on how much
money you need and do you have a pension, what's your Social Security benefit look like, you know, those other sorts of things. I like Roth IRAs too because they're tax-free forever for everyone forever and ever so far.
Great. That's what I was going to say so far, because I know at least one accountant who says, you know what the problem is that what if they change that legislation, right? What if the government
They'll always grandfather it. So they'll just stop it, right? Rarely has the government gone and said, we're going to take away this thing for everybody who's...
That's right.
You know what I mean? They might just go, you know what? This is the last year for Roth contributions, right, and we're going to change them so that at death,
right,
now they must be withdrawn within 5 years, you know, or whatever. So you're not going to be able to legacy those things out for 200 years like you can right now.
Yeah, there hasn't been one where they just, that I can remember, somebody might write in and prove me wrong. Yeah. But I think not since Reagan has there been a tax shelter that was suddenly changed and people were left holding the bag. And those were those oil wells, some of the limited partnership stuff that was out there. That's the last one I remember. Thanks for the question, Evan. If you've got a question for the Courtesy Hotline, send those to stackybenjamins.com/voicemail. And, you know, if you can't remember stackybenjamins.com/voicemail, just go to the stackybenjamins.com. And on the right-hand side of the page, you'll see leave us a voicemail. And that's the Courtesy Hotline. All right. Doug also has handed us, he keeps trying to show me these old family photos, and I really don't care. But what I do care about is we have this letter from Daryl. Pretty good letter. Daryl says, I've been listening to the podcast a few months, but Stacking Benjamins is by far my favorite. I listened to episode 109 last week, in which you answer a letter about the actual worth of CFPs and financial advisors. That particular scenario was targeted at someone near to retirement. It seems that the value of advisors has been a common topic over the last week or so as well. He wrote this a month ago, so...
I'm like, I don't remember talking about that.
Just so everybody knows, it takes us a little while to get to your letter. My question is, when would you suggest looking at advisor or planner? My wife, 27, and I, 29, each contribute the full employer match to our 401k, and I contribute the $5,500 match to my IRA. We pay off our credit cards in full each paycheck and each have fully funded emergency funds, as well as a little bit of extra savings for rainy days. We also recently bought a house and don't see a kid in the near term. Our total cumulative investments are just over $60,000. We don't try to play the market. We each reallocate once per year and have some funds in target date funds, QOGSI.
I actually had a little reflux that happened as soon as you said that, but...
We've got sound financial principles, but should we already...
Not totally sound if you've got those target date funds.
But should we already be looking for an advisor, giving our relatively low investment balance for the possible extra 2-3% and sweet, sweet compound interest over the next 30 plus years? Thanks for the question, Daryl. Before you jump on Daryl's awesome note here, I just have one point, which is if you are hiring a financial advisor to get an extra 2-3% return... You might be hiring an advisor for the wrong reason. And if an advisor also buys into that they can play the market better than you can play the market. My job when I was a financial advisor was two things. It was making sure that your blind spots are paved over so you have none, right? Because everybody has some. And making sure that that's taken care of. And then number two, making sure that, and remember we talked earlier about the best battles, the one that's never fought? About helping you look at the future and set up your savings in a way so that you never have to fight battles, which is frustrating for me because then proving your worth as a financial advisor is like, well, nothing happened last year. You should be high-fiving me, dude, because I did my job because I made sure that you had the appropriate money in the appropriate place at the right time. The extra 2-3%, sometimes, yeah, but that's not really a reason to hire a financial advisor, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think what he's talking about is that Vanguard article that we referenced, the value of advisors.
Right.
Is a great article.
Well, and I guess you're right. The value of your portfolio, I'm saying maybe not like if you're looking at your 401k, but your net worth,
it's very well possible. It's not linear, right? It's not like you can sit down with a client and say, this year we outperformed 1.7% and I charged 1% and therefore... I was worth an extra 0.7 this year. I think all of the things that you said about being an advisor are all true, right? Finding the blind spots, making you aware of new opportunities, my kind of spiel, I guess, is do you think that we can make you an extra 1% in ideas that maybe you didn't know about, or save you 1% in mistakes that you were going to make, and or free up 1% of your time, right? So you have to look at those things as well, like your time. Maybe this is something that you really enjoy. For you, you're doing all the right things. So maybe the right thing is to hire an advisor, pay him a fee to do a plan to check in, and then off you go. You don't need that ongoing portfolio management, asset management, ongoing handholding, that sort of thing. Maybe yours is more of a check-in. Maybe you're the type of person where you say, I've got this ball going in the right direction, but I want to hand it off now. I don't want to do that anymore. I think the true value of an advisor happens when something catastrophic happens and they prevent you from making that lifetime altering mistake. Whether it's they convince you, and it really does take convincing, that you need to have $2 million of life insurance, not the $200,000 that you have through your group plan. And they, the advisor, finally said, you got to take care of your family. You got to take care of your family. And then something happens and now your family's taken care of. That one life-altering mistake. You could pay an advisor for 100 years and they've more than paid their worth. Or it's March 6, 2009, the market's down 40% and you call and say, I want out. Get me out, get me out, get me out. I told you I was in for the long term, but I didn't realize it was going to be like this. And that advisor says, no, stay the course. Your plan is not a six-month market fluctuation plan. Your plan is for 30 years. And since you stay the course, you've experienced a 3.5-fold increase in your portfolio value since March of 2009, as contrasted to half the population that's still sitting in cash because they're waiting for the market to recover.
Yeah.
That is the value of the advisor.
And maybe it's not the right time for Daryl. Maybe it is the right time for Daryl. Here's what I would do. I would schedule a meeting with a couple, a few, and see if that person feels like somebody that would be my agent would be, because I think of it like a sports agent. Right? That's what I think of when I think of a good financial advisor, which I think a lot of the world doesn't think of it that way. And I don't get that because they should be. They're your agent. They're your advocate. You should expect that person to actively disagree with you. Yeah. And if they do, but they do it in a way where you know they're on your team, I think they're a huge asset to your company. I look at families as companies, and I think they're a huge asset. But if they don't, then Daryl shouldn't hire them. And maybe what Daryl needs, you know, like as an example, we were talking to a friend of ours the other day that just what he will do is like a checkup meeting with somebody. Somebody says, hey, they don't want to hire an advisor long term, but they want somebody with initials after their name who's going to make sure all the I's are dotted, T's are crossed, and give them the stamp.
Yeah, give them a punch list of here's the stuff.
Yeah, it's just like taking your car in for the, you know, X point inspection, you know, that type of thing. Maybe that adds value. But because I do think that by and large, a lot of the stuff that Daryl's doing is right on. But also,
Most of your clients like really good friends? Were you really good friends with them?
Well, not when I first met them, but but as we got to know each other. And it's funny because I would actively disagree with them and we become better friends.
Yeah.
Perfect
example. I've always said, how can we be lovers if we can't be friends? That's kind of my theory on that. But I would like to think that every one of my clients, I want every one of my clients to text me from Costco at 2 o'clock on a Sunday and go, so I'm thinking about buying this cool insert thing here at Costco.
Big screen TV.
Yeah. I'm at the car dealership. The guy's really making a good case for leasing the car. What do you think? I want that text at 4 o'clock on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Because I want to be that person that they respect enough and that's in their corner enough that they can call on and go, make this happen. I've negotiated car purchases for clients. They call and go, hey, I really want this car, but, you know, can you get this guy down anymore? I go, yeah, sure. Put him on the phone. I'm like, well, Mr. Salcia, this is his accountant or this is his financial planner. And, you know, I'm sorry, but Mr. and Mrs. Salcia, the liquid right now position is only $25,000. So that's the only, you know, that's the most we can do with this car purchase. I can wire it to you. I can have it there by 4 o'clock if you're ready to, you know, I want to be an advocate for them. Yeah. And if that's what you're looking for, great advisor. You'll find one.
Yeah, good question. We could do a whole, this is for us, this is like inside baseball. We could talk this one all day. We've had like four topics today that you and I could have had an entire episode on.
Maybe we should do that in our free time.
Create a new podcast where we just...
Frivolouslawsuits.com. That's
right. Thanks for the question, Daryl. If you've got a question, please send those to us, joe@stackandbenjamins.com. That's going to do it for this episode, man. Thanks again to Tiffany, the budgetista, Tiffany Leche, for coming on The Basement. OG, we'll see you back here next Monday. We'll be back here, everybody, on Friday, stacking more Benjamins. See you later.
So what's the point of today's show? But first, we can talk about high fees and sue companies and universities so fees are lower, but that isn't the real reason people aren't retiring on time. And getting out of debt? Well, finding sources of money that you didn't think you had and taking drastic action might be in your future. But the main point? Well, it's that every family has a mission, and mine happens to be sold one screamer, push-up, or ice cream sandwich at a time. This show is the property of the Free Financial Advisor, LLC. The show is created by Joe Salcihi, produced by Richie Rutter Reese, and edited and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Special thanks to Tiffany Alice, a.k.a. The Budgetnista. Find out more about her Live Richer Challenge at thebudgetnista.com or on our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Special thanks to Joe's mom for explaining to me why my new ice cream company slogan, "If you want a screamer, I'm your guy," has more than one meaning. Who knew? From now on, I'll just ask people if they like to lick my fudge pop. Oh, you gotta be kidding me.
My backlog of movies keeps getting longer. And I have to tell you, I started watching that Tony Robbins movie that you talked about last week. I'm Not Your Guru.
A couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah, you talked about it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Oh, you started watching it last week. It's a dangling modifier. Sorry.
Yeah. You talked about it last Monday, actually. Oh, okay. About a week and a half ago. And it
feels like a longer time ago than that.
But. And I started watching it, and I got 10 minutes into it, and I got so fired up, I turned it off, and I went and I started working furiously.
Have you done anything? Have you watched any more of it?
I haven't, because I'm saving it for when I need that kick in the in the pants.
Yes. I still love that. That guy is so awesome. My wife watched it and she was like, "We need to go to that." Like, that just seems awesome to me.
My problem is I will spend the entire hour and a half watching that. And I know me, I'll go, no, don't go work now. Don't go do it now. Just wait and see what the final message is and then do it. And then the same message is this, you know, it's a little different than the message I had 10 minutes in. But if I can parse that out a little bit at a time and use that as fuel for maybe a month, that may go.
That's the way that you want to do it.
I need that, you know, every once in a while you need that motivation. But I got a movie on the other end of the spectrum. You saw We Are the Millers, right?
Oh, yeah.
Movie by the same people that did We Are the Millers. Came out a little while ago, just left theaters, hopefully getting ready to go out on video here fairly soon. This is Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, and Kevin Hart, and the movie's called Central Intelligence.
My man!
You better back up, man!
Whoa, Calvin, it's me, Bob.
Sorry, do I know you?
Robbie Weir Dick. From high school.
God, man, look at you. You've lost like 200 pounds. What did you do?
I just did one thing.
I need to know.
I worked out 6 hours a day, every day, for the last 20 years straight. You should know one thing about me. I'm in the CIA.
Are you joking with me right now?
Drop your weapon! Do it now! I got a plan. Might get us both killed, but if it works, it'll be a totally boss story. Cool?
No. No, it's not cool.
Cool.
No, I said it's not cool.
So the movie opens up with Robbie Weirdick. What a fantastic name for Dwayne Johnson's character. He is the fat kid, the geek in high school, and he likes to shower in the men's shower room and sing show tunes or sing crazy,
obviously
crazy music. And so at the very beginning of the movie, some of the guys in his class, while they're having a pep assembly, apparently the guy likes to shower during the pep assembly. So they sneak in and they throw his naked butt out in the middle of the floor. And Kevin Hart's character, who's the most popular guy in school, he saves him by giving him his varsity jacket to cover up, and it goes from there. Now it's obviously it's 20 years later, and now Robbie Weirdick is back in the picture. And that's them. What you heard there was them meeting for beers when their first meeting is like, what happened to you? Because now he looks like Dwayne Johnson.
He looks like The Rock.
Yes. And he's like, what happens to you? Because Kevin Hart, who was the most popular guy in school, is now an accountant, kind of bored with his life. And they do a CIA mission together. And you know, what's funny is that I never heard much press about this. In our job, I follow the news a lot. I follow films a lot. Didn't hear a lot of people talk about this movie. I know that it didn't have huge box office numbers. I don't think it was a failure. It really wasn't a success. This movie is funny, OG. It was funny. It was crisp. It was new. It had action. The plot moved. I thought it was really, I love a movie. I didn't know anything about this movie except who was in it when I went to see it. And I really like that because I sat down, I knew Zippo, and I laughed my head off.
Yeah, all I know is that it's supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
And they get into some kind of trouble.
Yes.
But they're like a team.
Now. Yeah. Not
intentional, but they just happen to be a team because they're in the same place at the same time.
And what's funny about their team is that Dwayne Johnson's character, who he plays really well, Dwayne Johnson's character is so weird that you're never let in on whether he's actually a good guy or a bad guy. And you don't know the entire movie. And in fact, they keep bringing up things that question, is Robbie Weirdick really a bad guy trying to steal secrets? Robbie Weirdick, is he stealing secrets from the United States, or is he really a good guy is he a rogue agent, or is he really a good agent? And just a hilarious movie. Well worth your time. I think it's going to be a great rental. Not as good, by the way. You know, I reviewed Bad Moms last week. Bad Moms, way better. Like, of the two, I would see Bad Moms before I saw this, but that's no cut on this movie. That's just how Bad Moms is still the funniest movie I've seen this year.
All right. Two glowing reviews right out.
Yeah.
As we get back into movie season.
And we'll get some reviews I might not have liked as much coming up.
I have to get back to the movies. As soon as my kids get back to school, I think I'll be able to peel myself out of this dungeon.
I've got three more to review. I've got a backlog that's going to take us a while. And I know we're going to have funny stuff come up that we're going to want to talk about here on the after show instead. So we might have the whole month of August. Plus, you know, I want to see Pete's Dragon. Like I was a kid that liked Pete's Dragon when it was originally out. So I can't wait to see that. And then I also want to see that one about the opera woman who sings just so bad. Like she's just absolutely
the one that they make fun of.
Yes.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's out now. So I'm excited about both of those movies. So even more to throw on the fire. All right, guys, that's it. We'll see you later. Meet us back over tomorrow on the Green Room, Stackamore Benjamins. See you later.